Firefighting is essential for our communities, but it's never been easy. Today, with increased heat loads and toxicity, the job's more dangerous than ever before. At MSA, our health and safety drives them to develop highly advanced safety equipment to protect us on the job. MSA's Globe Gear is performance and protection in perfect balance. It's designed to meet the challenges we face every day and to keep us safe and healthy during our careers and beyond. Get the full story at msafire.com/globe.
Hey, good afternoon, and welcome to the Fire Engineering Hump Day Hangout here with Traditions Training and the International Society of Fire Service Instructors as we embark on another one of our Hump Day Hangouts. Thanks to Fire Engineering and the Clarion Group for sponsoring all this, letting us get our message out, and we greatly appreciate it. So on today, we have, we're going to have to call him Chief Shaw from Virginia, and we have Chief Shaw from Florida, and we have Mr. Heller, Tony Carroll, and we haven't got Larry or anybody else on. I know we had a bunch of conflicting schedules today, so what kind of, Tony, are you able to talk to us now? He's still having problems connecting, so. Okay, we'll get Tony on here in a minute, I'm sure. So as we kind of went back and forth today, one of the things that's been kind of a hot topic with my organization is incident commander training and chief training. So that's kind of one of the things I wanted to hit on today. I know it doesn't hit you know, the whole genre of all our firefighters out there, and it's not too sexy as stuff as beating down doors and stretching hose lines and venting roofs and breaking glass or anything like that, but it's pretty critical, I think, to have a good process. So we have a good swath of the country here with our, you know, the participants that are on today, and just try to feel out what each one are doing to prepare their chiefs to be incident commanders. But you know, I'm going to start with Dan Shaw here in a minute, but wanted to make sure that we remembered today's July 1st. This date in 1998, 32 years ago, we had five firefighters. Suffer a tragic line of duty death at the Hackensack Ford dealership fire. Obviously, that fire changed a lot about the fire service and the way we operate. And I think we have to remember those firefighters. Even though they tragically died, they have certainly saved hundreds of lives in the fire service since then. So make sure that everybody, I've seen it on Fire Engineering, Firefighter Nation, and more than one website or Facebook group today has a review of that fire. So I urge you, you know, if you get done listening to this, then obviously maybe get your crew together and let's review that Hackensack fire and learn some of the stuff that we learned from that day is still applicable to the fire service today. So 32 years doesn't bridge the gap. So Chief Dan, I had a bunch of stuff I have written down for stuff that I think that we should do for our chief officers, and I'll see how that fits into yours. But how do we get our battalion chiefs, our young battalion chiefs, which is what we're getting now? Of course, that could be because I'm getting older.
It is.
You know, I still have this. So, you know.
When you said Hackensack was 32 years ago, I'm like, oh my Lord.
Yeah, I know I'm getting old then. So I had to do the math twice because I didn't want to believe it. So.
It's a huge, I always contest, and obviously every organization is different in the way they structure, but you know, two of the ranks that we really neglect in continuing ed is the apparatus driver and the battalion chief. Apparatus driver, once you make the rank, you're good to go. There's no continuing ed. There's no continual evaluation unless you're really a progressive organization, which is fantastic. And then battalion chief, you know, once you make the rank, you went through some sort of promotional process where you're evaluated, and then, you know, you're doing a job, so you must be okay. And I think that's where we really miss the mark. And when we come back to looking at training our battalion chiefs to be successful and effective on the fire ground, I think you take one step back, right? I mean, the captains who arrive on that first arriving engine, a lot of times they don't have to get the sets and reps to do it. And depending where you work, if you work in a more urban area where you have chiefs that are there pretty regularly, you know, they don't ever have to take command. So I think it's important that, you know, we train the company level officers to understand that, hey, look, you're the first unit arrives, you have command. You should not transfer command to a unit that's not on the scene. Yeah, you have command, and you might be just in command yourself because you're the only unit there. But if you're running command, you're doing well, it's effective, then that's where you get some sets and reps. And then we progress to the point you get the battalion chief, because it's such a hard transition to go from the tactical task level operation, i.e. stretching a hose line, breaking down a door, doing a search, and then pulling yourself back to this position where you're now responsible for all the outcomes. You're not producing the outcomes, you're responsible for all the people who are producing the outcomes. And so you have to, you know, make sure that you can now make that separate. You're not getting so bogged down, you can take a larger view. And I think incident command, in my view, really comes down to is two things. There, you're there to provide strategy and tactics based upon what you see and what you hear, and make sure they match. And if they don't, that's why you exist. So if someone tells me, hey, the fire's knocked on the number 2 floor and I see fire still coming out of the window, you're not thinking like, man, it must be delusional. No, they're operating one less sense. They can't see. They think one room off is out, and it's not. So then that's when you employ correct strategy and tactics. And then second is you're there to provide a measure of accountability. You must know where everyone is operating. And it comes back to the Powell Doctrine, right? You know, don't put anyone in harm's way for unclear purposes. So if you're going to put someone in the harm's way, an IDLH, to go fight fire, do a search, wherever it is, you better have a purpose to it, and you better know where they are and have the resources available to go get them. So you know, we always try to kind of break down our training for our chiefs to the most simplistic level of, hey, here's two core principles you want to think about: applying the correct strategy and tactics based upon what you see and what you hear. And then secondly, the second thing you have to do is provide that measure of accountability. And what I have found over the course of my time as a battalion chief, and then my last few years as a deputy, is that when I show up on the fire ground as the ops deputy, you know, I'm always evaluating the same exact things, and how effectively do we complete and execute the seven most important things we do on the fire ground, which is our communication, our positioning, establishing two water supplies, our first and second hose line, our primary secondary search, our ladders and ventilation. And I would tell you, when I arrive on a fire ground and those seven things are done, 99.9% of the fires are out. When a fire doesn't go well, I can usually track back to one of those things that got missed. You know, we didn't pick up a secondary water. Our on-scene report was atrocious. We didn't communicate well a 360. We didn't do well on getting the first line and second line in place because we didn't locate, confine, compartment, and then extinguish the fire. So it is really a basic fundamental task, but it's the ability for that incident commander to take that higher view, look at the entire fire ground, and think about not what's happening now. Think about, here's my plan, and where do I expect to be in 20 minutes? And how effective is my plan going there? So that includes having those benchmarks to be able to sit back and take a look and say, all right, is what I'm doing working? And some of these advents that we put in place, like, you know, a command board and having that, we got to be very careful that someone doesn't just do a checklist manifesto and run a fire. You actually have to look at the fire. And
Dan locked up there.
You have to make sure that with your goals of understanding incident command, and then we can get our incident commanders sets and reps, command training centers. I mean, the advent of the computer and social media and the nonstop sharing of fire videos is such a great training aid to sit down with your chiefs and put up a video and say, all right, give me your on-scene report. Where would you put your first line, second line? Where would you focus your search? What kind of ventilation do you think is appropriate on this? And you're coming back to those seven steps and those seven key elements of success on the fire ground and having that dialogue. So I think it is, you know, one, understanding the core principles of incident command, and then having the ability to actually train and develop mastery within that position. And that really is a whole package to be able to start building that good incident commander at the battalion chief level.
Okay, so Dan kind of set it in the motion about the expectations of the chief and what his seven things are. But I wrote down a couple of mine, then I'll go down to Chief Shaw from Florida, then Mr. Heller, and then Chief Heller, and then Chief Carroll. Some of the stuff that I wrote down is some of mine is by trial and failure. In another organization I work for, is to have a clear set of expectations for the battalion chief or any operational chief, and that clear set of expectations is written down. So the stuff that Dan's talking about, whether it be having the lines, secondary water supply in place, you know, where the ladder is supposed to be. So, and I hate to use the checklist as the point, is that so there's a something that a person can look at and understand, hey, they expect this level of accountability. Hey, they expect me to use a command chart. Hey, they expect me to wear a headset. You know, so all those things are down there so that incident commander has a clear understanding of what the department expects from him. So, obviously taking the cue from the Northern Virginia region is that, you know, I created a command manual. So all my expectations were in that command manual, because what I was finding out was the battalion chiefs had a hard time reading my mind of exactly what I wanted. So we'd have some problems back and forth because of my inability to get clear expectations out to them. So, and the next thing after we set those clear expectations with like a command manual was to have a clear process or checkoff for them to either act or become a battalion chief. So a lot of it's called a task book. So they had to, understand how to operate radios, understand how to use the headsets, how to use the command charts, use the incident command checklist, all the radios in the back of the vehicle, and then, going through a series of items for the vehicle and for the command aids that we have, because command aids is one of the big things that I really hit on, is having an incident commander's checklist book. And yeah, I believe in a checklist. I swear by them, but you can't be a checklist incident commander, as Dan alluded to, is that you can't have an incident commander sitting there just reading down every box that's on the command chart just so he can check it off. Because if he's not looking at the building, he's not listening to his companies on the radio, and he's so focused on that chart, then that's going to be a failure on the fire ground. So once we get the clear expectations, get them through a process for a task book, give them good command aids. And, the command aids, once again, is like a set of the checkoff list, the incident commander checkoff list, and also a command chart, and that they're actually know how to use them and can operate them is a good thing. Then we try to run them through simulation training. So, using Sims You Share, what's the one out of California that I've forgotten, which was always the big one? Fire Studio. Yeah, I'm sorry. And then getting them in there. And then obviously we've been trying to do a lot of it, not in a classroom setting, where we've actually now have a screen sitting in front of the chief's car. We project that on there, and then we have radio traffic. We have all the crazy radio traffic that people have, people bidding on calls, people using, not giving good messages out, whether an ambulance marking on the scene, or, somebody, saying heavy fire four times in a row, just something to distract them a little bit, have people knocking on the window, all those pieces to get that incident commander as well as we can. So when he shows up at an incident scene, that he's going to have all these stressors that is going to add to the incident. So a good mentor program, enough can't be said about that. Having a good incident commander as a mentor, somebody that you can call and talk to, producing ride-alongs, even though I think it's a critical part is to have that new battalion chief riding with somebody, either be their mentor or a fully checked off battalion chief. I couldn't tell you what are the chances of them actually catching a fire or catching a good run during that time, but we got to get them through the process. And the last piece, and then I'll let everybody else comment, is the constant critique part. Dan was alluding to how old I was earlier. I've been an incident commander for a long time, but almost after every fire that I run or I'm fortunate enough to be an incident commander, I'm calling somebody. How did we sound? What did I miss? What did we do wrong? What could we have done better? And that's usually on the ride from the fire back to the firehouse, because I want that instant feedback. That I messed something up. I didn't mess something up. We need to do this better. and then being able to take that piece in. I think that's a hard part for Chiefs sometimes, is that we ask for feedback, but we don't necessarily want to hear the feedback sometimes. But I want somebody to tell me that, hey, you missed this radio transmission, you missed that radio transmission, we didn't follow this process, you know, whether I missed something, you know, if we had an emergency retreat, or, you know, we had, unfortunately, if we had a mayday, if I missed a piece of that process, you know, and didn't go through it on the checklist, I want to know that. So even though you got the bugles on your shoulder and you do command a lot of good men and women out in the field, I think that you need to be humble. And one of the things that we said, it's at the command post, it needs to be an egoless command post, and that all those people that are in that car with you or standing there with you can give you information, help you out. But at the end of the day, you're the one making the decision. And all those things that we talked about before are going to help you make those decisions. And obviously, experience is the best thing in the world. But, you know, we're not burning down our cities every day. So we got to use all these other processes. So I'm going to go down the boxes here, and we'll go down to Shaw, Florida. And you can chime in there, Chief.
First of all, I wanted to comment to Chief Shaw. I will tell you that the same, your first comment was true up north and it's true down south. The areas that we are not focusing on enough, the driver engineers and the chief officer training. So it's the same down here as it is up in your neck of the woods. And I guess I have a little bit of advantage. When I was running the chair of the training group for the Broward area last couple years, I had a really good opportunity to see what was being done in like the South Florida region between Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, some of the West Coast, and the problems we're having here, the same you're up there with trying to get our NC commanders trained, what kind of training do they need? And you mentioned a couple of those as well. But Chief, you mentioned something regarding mentoring, and I kind of like to focus on that for a second. So I keep a picture on my wall back here. I don't mean to tell war stories, but I keep this picture on the wall behind me because it's such a relevant picture for me. When I was upgrading a lot, when I was a lieutenant, upgrading to EMS captain and battalion chief back in the day, I ran this fire. It was my second clubhouse fire that I had. The first one I went to, I was responsible for water supply, some technical issues, learned a lot from it. So when I was running this call, I was first on scene as an upgraded EMS captain, took command, was able to run with this for a while. And the lessons learned I had from the previous fire helped me really dial in this one. So when the other chief officers showed up, I gave my report and they let me run with it. They said, Steve, you're doing great. Keep going. I'll be ops. I'll be safety. I'll be the seaside ops side, whatever. And that feeling of empowerment and trust was massive. 2 days later, I was back on shift as a lieutenant. And one of the other chiefs, my regular chief, came to me and he goes, hey, I heard you had a fire. I'm like, yeah, it went pretty well. He goes, yeah, I would have taken command from you. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, you were an upgrade. I would have taken from you. I would have assigned you operations or safety or medical or something. I'm like, you suck. Anyway, let me take this down a little bit. So I guess my point is that I learned a lot about the concept of coaching and mentoring that day. And what I mean by that is I think it has to be, and you use clear communication before, it has to be clear communication when you're in a coaching or a mentoring topic or discussion. Now, if whoever's watching this, kind of ask yourselves, what does that culture look like in your organization? Is it detailed? Is it formalized? Is it an SOP? Is it what you do? Is it part of your program? Is it part of a task book? Or is it part of a sign-off? Or is it more informal? Regardless of which way the mentoring or coaching is, it does come from both sides. Hopefully, if it's not formalized, it definitely comes from both sides, from the individual who is the person that wants to be mentored, and the people that are above watching a person upgrade to a position or fill that role as a new chief or a new incident commander, or a new officer, has to come from both sides. So from the person that is that person that's stepping up or learning, they got to reach out. You got to ask me. I'm a good example. I'm on days right now as the EMS chief. I was in training for a long time. I still miss operations. So I've already reached out to the operations chief since already asked all three shifts. Hey, listen, I'm going to run calls. Can I watch you? Can I mentor with you? Can I be part of the incident command structure? And it's amazing what you get when you ask. They're like, of course, absolutely. I'll have you do this. I'll have you do that. I'll have you run the call. And that mentoring's already started. We haven't even run calls yet. And we're already having those dialogues. From the top down, when you have those people that are filling those roles, don't just Don't just let them fill the role or ride the seat or and not do anything with it. There needs to be a plan in place. You need to start that dialogue. Again, it goes back to clear communications. Hey, I see you're the new officer. I see you're the incident commander. I see you're this. Hey, we're going to work with you. We're going to help build you. I want to make sure you understand I'm going to help build you. So there's that clear, open discussion. It has to be there. It can't just be assumed. If you're assuming something, if you're assuming the person in that seat knows what they're doing or has the experience, you got some problems. You need to have those dialogues. And whatever that looks like, tabletop, whiteboard, the fire sim stuff, whatever that looks like. So obviously I'm very passionate about to make sure that, there's a mentoring that's going on, that it's a two-way street. It's better if it is formalized, but if it's not, make it to where it's understood. I will say I did some research prior to coming on today about what's being done in the South Florida area. And I just give you an idea, what's going on down here. It's all over the spectrum. I will say I'm very proud of a lot of departments down here. Most departments have some sort of officer development program. That's where you see a lot of that incident commander training, the initial part of the programs. Ongoing, a little bit more challenging. Some have experienced or experimented with things like the blue card program, but that is expensive and sometimes it's grant funded and it's very far and few between. Some have a little more formalized mentorship program or a ride along program, definitely an upgrade program. The last thing I'll say is this. I'm a big proponent of upgrading and learning while you're stepping up or riding out of class or being, filling a role above you. But I will tell you what I don't like is every so often I'll hear somebody in that upgraded position or that chief for a day position, and they'll go, yeah, I'm a substitute teacher. I hate that statement. My blood pressure is rising right now. I hate when somebody says I'm a substitute teacher. I think that if I hear that, I usually will take that person to the side and have a nice long talk with him or her. When you're at that position, you're that position. You're the captain, you're the company officer, you're the battalion chief. And if you're on scene, you're that position. The option to go, well, you know, I didn't have this or you are that position. There's no substitute teachers in the fire service. I hate that statement. I've tangented it off a little bit. I'm going to bring it back. I'm big on the mentoring, like you mentioned. I'm glad you brought it up. I think it's huge. And I would ask everybody that's watching this to ask what their mentoring or coaching looks like in their department. And are they doing enough on their side to ask for it and to bring it towards them and the people above them, including themselves looking down upon, amongst the ranks, doing enough for those people. So that's where I'll leave it. So.
Well, I'm substitute teaching for Bobby Halton today, so I guess we'll go to Chief Heller next. Good info, Steve. Appreciate it.
Chief Heller? Thank you, Rick. Thanks. Well, you guys already covered some really important points, and I think a lot goes into the size of your department as well. Can you look within your department to get that mentoring, or do you need to look outside your department? Because where I work, I was a captain for over 20 years before I made it to a chief's level. So there was very little room for growth. There was very little progression at the time. Now, all of a sudden, we're looking at, we're going into this new department where we're going to be a consolidated organization and we're going to be much larger. I think we'll have much more opportunity for a lot of these things to improve our officer candidates, as well as our current officers, because even our current officers, we lack. There's things that we certainly lack. The IC training, so to speak, we don't have an official program. We send guys to the NFA. I know when I became an officer, they sent us to Leadership 1, 2, and 3. And it was a great program. The guy who taught it was spot on. He went way outside the realm of simply what an NFA CAN program is, and made it really interesting, and I got a lot out of it. But we haven't truly said, this is how our program is going to work. And it's been kind of a go as you kind of learn as you go thing. And that doesn't make for the best officers. I know for me, I made lots of mistakes before I seemed to grasp gain traction in being a good officer. And here it is years later, and I'll never be as good as I should be. Because there's always, as Ricky said, as Chief Riley said, going back to the firehouse, what are you doing? You're immediately critiquing yourself. A good officer critiques himself. You have to be able to look in the mirror. You have to be able to say, what did I do right? What did I do wrong? As a baseball player, if I went 3 for 4, I was a little pissed off that I didn't get that fourth hit. And I'm the same way as a fire officer. If I did everything right, but these couple things at that fire, even if they were somewhat minor, I'm not happy with that performance. And I think the minute you're happy and complacent, you probably want to retire. So some of the things that we talked about there, I think the clear set of expectations is a big deal, even for company officers. And then if we've laid it out closely for a company officer, we're gonna have that next level, and we can continue to build upon that. And that's something that I didn't have, and that's something that I'm trying to instill in our people, is what we truly expect of you. This is why, this is what you should be studying, and having true resources. The mentoring program has been huge to me. There's chiefs above me who I have really, really leaned on, asked, hey, can I do a ride along with you guys? Because I just want to get better at what I'm doing. And, you know, even if we don't catch a job, like Chief Riley said, you know, the chances are we're not going to see a fire that day. But even if we don't catch a job, what can we do? We can go around the districts. He can show me how he's or she is doing things in the office, how you're interacting with your crews on duty and your visits to the firehouses. You know, I've seen too many chiefs that they don't go visit their firehouses when it's their day to be the BC or district chief. How does that work? Like, I need to see who's working. I want to interact with these guys. And I think it's important as a fireman and a boss to have that chief come in and say, hey, fellas, how's things? What can we do? So that helps build that relationship with your crews. And in the end, that's going to make you a better incident commander when you know who's working where, what's going on. So that's a big thing to me. As far as on the scene goes, you know, command and transfer of command, we tell our first new officer, if it's a captain, lieutenant, whatever, he's got command until relieved. Unfortunately, many of our chiefs and many of our officers, as they sign on radio, they're kind of taking command, which I disagree with. As a chief, when I get there, I prefer a face-to-face. If that junior officer is doing well, isn't this the best time for that junior officer to get lots of experience? I can stand back and watch and obviously be on the radio if need be, but I'd rather give them that opportunity. Coming from a volunteer system, and this always irked me, years ago when I was a volunteer officer, I watched a department next to me. The chief answered about 98% of the runs. He was great. He knew his stuff inside and out. But his lieutenants, captains, and assistant chiefs weren't worth a damn when he got out of office because he had never allowed them to do it themselves. So if we don't let people, you know, in lower ranks work their way up and run these things with supervision, how do you expect them to be good? It just doesn't work. So these are little things. And we talked about, you know, everybody's got lots of different monikers, different things to go forward. One of the best things that I learned many, many years ago, Ray Hoff was a retired Chicago chief, and Ray talked about bagging a fire. If you know where the fire's been, where the fire's at, and where the fire is going, you can do a lot of good things. And I've used that. I used it as a captain, but I certainly use it as a chief now, because as Chief Riley said, getting that bigger picture. I can have all the checklists and a command board, but if I'm buried in my command board or buried just in my checklist, I'm probably not paying attention to the really important stuff that they're paying me to pay attention to. The building, the fire reaction, whether our guys are making an influence on the job or not, you know, all these things. So it's all about, my opinion is, it's all about a good mentoring program. It's all about getting out in your district and seeing what you've got and who you've got. The simulations I really like. I was just in Louisiana this past week, so I'm probably supposed to be quarantined now. But we went out and we did a field trip to all their target hazards. And it was with all their officers. And we gave them radios and said, these are the scenarios and run them. And it went great. It was something they hadn't done. So we can get creative and we can make better chiefs. I'm sure of that. So sorry, I went for a while there, Rick, but there I am.
No, man, go. That's all good stuff. We got plenty of time. So, Tony Carroll, are you able to hear us and you're able to talk to us?
Yeah. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, you're terrible, by the way.
No, you can't.
We can't hear you at all, Tony. All right. You know what? They do not have internet in Woodbridge, Virginia, or something. You know, you need to move to like Fairfax or something where the internet's free, apparently. So
yeah, well, they'll probably blame us for stealing their internet.
Hey Dan, did you want to on that stuff that I went down? I know that I didn't mention that before you got on.
Yep. That's a problem, but not there. I'm not Dan, there. Can you hear me now?
That's bad.
Yeah, that is bad. It's bad, Tony. So Dan, what did you want to go on about the stuff that I went down? Or
yeah, I mean, I think there's two points I think are really important. I mean, first is, and I'm with you on the checklist, and this is where checklists really work out well. Is checklists is like, almost like when we run a fire, and it's me and my aide. I'm the pilot, they're the co-pilot. The minute I hit a stressful situation or I hit something that is, it's coming off of rails, I look to my co-pilot because I have to continue to fly the plane. I have to continue to manage the firefight. If my aide has a checklist for mayday, par check, whatever it is, they can easily be able to pull that information up and work through it with me and keep me on tab of like, all right, chief, I continue to manage a firefight. Here's a checklist we hit onto. Because what we don't want is we don't want incident commanders who get upset because of the fire or their surprise when the fire doesn't assimilate to your checklist, because the fire always gets a vote. You care less about whether you showed up tired, your lieutenant, and you're filling in, your first day as a chief, doesn't matter. Always gets a vote. So that's why we exist to be able to handle that tactical change. But one of the things I think you had touched to on, Ricky, and called it critiquing, and I think this is where we have a big gap in the fire service is, if you draw the communications loop of what we have on the fire ground, we start with how we do size up. We do our on-scene report. We take a lap. We have a situation report, command statements, future reports, can reports, things of that nature. And then we're at the closure of the incident, and that's where it just falls off the rails. And we don't close that loop. We call it a tailboard critique, where essentially we pull the company officers immediately after the fire that's knocked down. It's a company officers. It's the incident commander. And we instituted it. We didn't give a whole lot of structure to it, so we've been trying to give some structure to it. But I would always come back to, especially as the ops deputy, is look, if we have high expectations for our people and they show up on the fire ground, and I would say the vast majority of times we're not dealing with cowards who are making acts of omission. They're making acts of commission. And maybe they miss some of these things. They want to hear what they missed, get better. And if they're doing something really good, how do we keep that going? And we want to have that direct dialogue with them. And then you finish closing that loop that, hey, if it's a big incident, we should have some after action report. We adopted something from Cal Fire where after their significant incidents, they have the blue sheet, green sheet. That has to be out in 24 hours from a line of duty death. They push out a document about what occurred. Here's the immediate lessons learned. 24 hours that they get something out that quickly. So we try to close the loop. We call it a turnout sheet, where as soon as a notable fire comes out, that, hey, if it was in one battalion on one shift, that's 70 people who got to go to that incident. But what about the other 1,400 who weren't there? How can they learn from that incident? So we push out those documents, and we're getting better and better at that. But, I think there's such a huge emphasis on the fact that if we're going to have high expectations at the beginning of the incident about communications, and we should have that same expectation when we get to the end of the incident to close it. Because you guys have all talked about it. That's the mentoring. And it's no secret. And I would always tell our guys, is like, when I go to a tailboard critique, I'm going to tell you the same seven things. How well did we do at these seven things? How good was our communications? How good was our positioning? Did we get two water supplies? How was our first line and second line selection? Was it effective? Our primary and secondary. How quickly did we get in place? How quickly did we search the structure? Our ladders. Do we get ladders to every single place we could until we ran out of windows or we ran out of ladders? And ventilation. What do we do and why do we do it and what impact do they have? And so we have this really good dialogue right there with the small unit leaders about what they did, And there is nothing better after a stressful situation to hydrate them, have them come back, sit there right now, and let's talk immediately about what happened. And we try to structure in the sense of we do that dialogue about the incident and then really roundtable, like, what went well? What did I do well that worked? And what did I not do that it was a detriment? And I usually like to start with the IC to say, hey, look, I thought the plan was really good. You guys executed it. I missed the mark on the par check, or I missed the mark on the opportunity to do some horizontal ventilation on side Charlie. And that really also, that's that ability of leadership, right? To show that you're humble enough in front of those people you're leading that, hey, as the IC, I missed some things, but you guys picked it up for me. And I always come back to, it's like, look, if we have to hold people accountable, including ourselves. If we do something bad, let's figure out why, and let's stop it from occurring again. If we do something good, let's figure out why it occurred and how do we keep that going. And that will never occur if you don't have that closing out of that communications loop on a fire ground.
Sorry, Dan. Let me get back here. Tony, we're going to give you another shot here, pal.
Is this better?
Can you hear
me now? I'm not in Northern Virginia. That's a problem. I'm in downtown Mineral, Virginia. So, I want to talk about the checklist. We do have a command sheet. I think it's a good idea, right, to kind of memory joggers and things like that. But we have some chiefs out there who already have some of the blanks filled in, you know, like they already have, they've already decided that they're going to have a vent group. They've already decided they're going to have, you know, an exposure group. And some of those things we're probably going to do with them, but we can't fight every fire the same way. And we fight every fire. So we do. One of the things I think that we do, we don't do well, and you know, I'm kind of jealous of some of those places around me, is that command stuff, the command training. I saw mission stop with the buggies, and I know you were doing some at your facility there at Apparatus. Fairfax, you guys are doing some of that command simulation stuff too. We are trying to get it off the ground. We had a investment years ago with some command training. We even had the blue card guys come and write some stuff when Larry was there, and it never really got off the ground. So we needed to do that, because you know that we can't wait for a high rise fire to train them on how to command a high rise fire, right? You may never get a good high rise fire that you can get. You can do all your different needs and sectoring and things like that. You may never get a good city. So you can't wait for this stuff. You can't wait for the OJT to be able to do it. So that kind of stuff, I picked up on what you guys said. Again, one of the things we do, we just had, and Aaron talked about it, Steven did too, about talking to each other, mentors and things like that. I just recently had a captain come ride with me for some OJT training. And again, he's really into the fire service. As I am, we talked a lot about what ifs. We sat around and talked about what if we get this run. And then ironically, he was acting in a chief position a couple of tours later, and we had a good high rise fire. He was the second chief there. And, you know, I could kind of look at him and tell him, hey, what we talked about, and he went and did it. And it was a great, working together there with the two chiefs I don't necessarily have with some others that we haven't sat around and just kind of BS'd. You know, that kitchen table talk, if you can do that, that would be a real good investment as
people are. Okay.
So hopefully I got more to talk about, but we can.
It's because you're breaking up so bad again, Tony.
You talked about, you know, having that first arriving guy assume command. We'll see. All right, you guys, I'll just.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Tony. The internet, I mean, it's really bad, unfortunately. I just don't know. So, Chief Shaw from Florida, did you want to hit on thing? I thought either you're writing some stuff down. I just thought you might want to have something else you wanted to comment on, or
I'm just a note taker. Yeah, that's just me. So my question for you is for a person in the department, and we don't use the checklists, but we've been talking about those. Is those the checklists, the benchmarks? Do you use those as part of your accountability boards in the back of your time sheets wagons, or do you use those as separate documents? How do those work in the function when you're commanding an incident?
We actually the department issued every battalion chief and every volunteer chief and volunteer assistant chiefs a book. So the book has a command chart in it that allows you to write down the unit location, staffing. And so you have that piece, and then you have all the other checklists in there, such as an emergency retreat, you know, tactical withdrawal, Mayday, you know, active shooter, all these different checklists to go through. So that book sits with you on the steering wheel, because we run everything from the front of the car. We have a thing that goes over the steering wheel. The book sits there. So, I mean, I was doing a simulation the other day, and once again, we just found out that we use Grab Lives as part of the process when we were talking to a downed firefighter. So I didn't have the Grab Lives check, you know, exactly everything that Grab Lives had in my checkbook. I had missed a page. So when I'm going through the simulation, you know, I'm marked down or, hey, we didn't go through the Grab Lives process. And that's because it wasn't in my book. So once again, the simulation drove me to, you know, make the books. When I opened it up, one half is the Mayday checklist and one half is the Grab Lives. So when I'm talking to the firefighter, so, you know, and I was noticing myself going back and forth between the command sheet and the Mayday till in the simulation, the second chief gets in the car, you know, and then I just hand him the Mayday book, you know, hand in the book with the Mayday in it, and I take the command sheet out and continue to run the command sheet from, you know, my position. We're two radios in a car, you know, if we switch channels. So, I mean, I'm an advocate for those things. I absolutely love them. I think they really have a good place on the fire ground. Once again, I think what Chief Heller was talking about, Chief Shaw and Chief Carroll, is that we cannot become that checklist incident commander, and because you see that, you hear it on the radio, you know what the guy's doing. I think I said this on one of the shows we did, I think over during the pandemic months, is that I think the checklist gets somebody with little experience or just simulation experience, it gets them in a right place. So at least they'll have something to look at when this bad thing happens on their fire ground or they're hit with a challenge with a type of typical incident. They have somewhere to go to find the information or at least the process to get them through it to one, either another chief gets there or, you know, it helps them get through that experience. Now, you know, obviously now if you have a good seasoned incident commander, he can go through those command charts pretty easily, but by far no stretch should any checklist run the incident scene. These are just mind joggers, you know, stuff. The thing that I use them for the most is those high stressful ones. So if we have a Mayday, I have a complete thing that I read down. It's very scripted, tells me when to set the tones off, what I'm supposed to say to everybody on the fire ground, you know, who we're looking for, who, what, and where. And it just, you fill all that stuff in. And so it makes a highly stressful situation easy to manage because everything that's on there, either through the clear expectations, through the general order, is all right there. And, you know, once again, you know, I can't say enough about command teams. Having that second person in the car with you, you know, that's what's going to save you. I mean, you can be a gray-haired incident commander and think you got it all down pat, man. When they hit that Mayday, I don't care who you are. You know, that's going to frazzle you a little bit. And, you know, you're going to have to manage the incident. It's going to knock you off a game for a second. And I think those books and those lists bring you back into it. And then the person sitting next to you, having those conversations like Chief Carroll was talking about, you know, with that captain, with that chief, you know, running those calls. Now you guys know you're on the same page. He knows by that sheet, because he has one in his book, what it looks like, what it's supposed to read like, and how it's supposed to act on the fire ground. So I think, once again, I think along with that command manual, setting the clear expectations, that incident commander checklist book gets everybody once again on a same page across the city, across the battalion, you know, across the county, however your system works, you know, so everybody's on that same sheet of music, because you never know what chief's going to be running with you, you know, and depending on your jurisdiction, you know, if you're having a busy day or, you know, what that captain's going to be doing. So, I mean, and Chief Shaw from Florida, I can certainly send you what we use, but we've proven them, I think, and they have to be massaged for sure. I mean, the first one you do is not going to be right. The second one you do may be a little right. The third or fourth, you might actually have it right. And then you go out and run a real incident, and you find out only half of it's right. But as long as you're willing to change them and keep moving forward with them, I think that's what gives them the concrete stability inside an incident command system and inside the car. So that answers your question. I'm really passionate about that one. I'm sorry.
No, it seems that way. No, but it also seems it probably sets the tone of the incident going right away. Because we all know if the first few minutes of the incident kind of set the tone. If it goes really well, it usually stays that well. But if it starts off haphazard, the size up sucks, there's something that happened that just threw you off kilter, it takes a while to get back up to speed where you want to be. So I imagine it also kind of makes sure everybody's on the same page and keeps those first few minutes coordinated and structured, which is important for everybody. So,
yeah, and I think that, Dan, let me get this one thing. I'll jump over to you and then jump down to Chief Heller. Is that the department gives us the latitude to somewhat customize those books. You know, we have to have the basic sheets in there. I don't like looking at a command chart when a company starts calling me, or, you know, I get that stressful radio call. So I have another sheet that I use. It's in the book. So this is the command sheet, and this is a visual sheet that's just made up of blocks. So I can write down what companies on the division one, what companies are division two. And usually I circle, you know, the division supervisor, who that I'm actually talking to. And then, so that way I have a better visual where they're at on this piece of paper, even though it seems simplistic, it really works pretty well for me that, you know, I have everybody written down here when I do my PAR check, all the companies are written down. And then this one is more of a visual when someone says, you know, hey, engine four, you know, on the second floor. Well, guess what? They're supposed to be on the third floor. They're supposed to be on the first floor. That's where I had them assigned. It's more visual. So it just takes getting used to and then working with them. So I kind of make sure that everybody, as the duty chief, when I show up, is that even if we're running a spark and outlet or food on the stove, do you have your book with you? And what have you filled out? Because the only way you get good at them is by using them. And then you got to use them on these small incidents. So when you get to that big incident, when you get to Tony's high rise fire, you're versed in them. You know, you're not, you know, looking around the chart trying to figure it out. So I'm sorry, Dan. What were you getting ready to say? I apologize.
No. And I was just going to give a different perspective. So, you know, we just finished our new command manual. We updated that thing pretty robustly. And part of that is our command boards. And what we found is that, you know, historically we had various boards. We had boards that were for the company officer that were in a smaller bag, that the company officer was given that bad news when they arrived that the chief was delayed. I need you to take command. They're like, oh my God, I got to go find that board. The battalion chief had a slightly bigger board, and then like the deputy got an even bigger board. And every time you got the command unit, it was like the coup de grace of boards. And they were all different, and which was, you know, now we've learned over, you know, 25 plus years of this, that, you know, it wasn't really that great. So what we went back to is a very simplistic command board that is the same for all units, looks exactly the same, just might be in different sizes. So you could track a second or third alarm off the board for the, you know, the battalion or the deputy. And the way we structured that board was, you know, the middle section is you can draw whatever you want, whatever the structure looks like, because our structures keep getting more and more diverse looking, and they're not going to fit it within boxes. So you might as well draw what you see and what works for you to track your units. But the left side was all your units. The right side was all ancillary information. But across the top banner were those seven things we talked about. You know, did you get your 360 report back? Did you get water supplies? Your first and second line? Are ladders thrown? Do you have ventilation performed? And so, you know, the reason we did that was that because when that company officer is told he has to take command, and they're like, my God, I got to think strategic and not tactical anymore, if they just looked at the top of the board and went through that short checklist and said, all right, you know, how can I handle this until the chief gets there? All right, I got my 2R supplies. You know, I got a 360. I know it's 2 in the front, 3 in the rear. All right, I got one line going here. I got the primary search started. Oh, let me get some ladders going. Because they're not always thinking that, so we use it as a trigger. And it's the same as when the battalion gets there. And you know, that's the same question I would ask when I get up to the chief's car and ask him, like, hey, what do you got? Because it is surprising sometimes you walk up to an incident commander 20 minutes into a fire and go, where's the fire? It's a good idea. Like, well, we got units inside the building. We don't know where the fire is. And we want to have some things that kind of assist that. And Ricky hit on it, and I just mentioned, like, I think it really is important that we indoctrinate some of this information, the legacy documents, call, you know, whatever you call them. For us, it's our command manual. And when we redid this command manual, we really wanted to make it less of a regurgitation of a NIMS document and more of a handbook that if you're the captain who has to fill in as a battalion, if you're the new battalion, if you're the battalion who's filling as a deputy, and if you're the new deputy and above, what are you doing on the fire ground? You know, what is your role and responsibility on the fire ground? And what does your language look like and what has evolved out of it? And so we really, I mean, semantic things, right? You know, we got rid of, you know, people saying heavy smoke and heavy fire, because I don't know how you weigh that stuff, so I don't know how it's heavy. But just being clear in your descriptions. Tactical withdrawals, we drop that. Like, you know, it's just a withdrawal. It's an evacuation or it's a withdrawal. And getting rid of unnecessary terms, because we're really trying to streamline everything that we want that incident commander to think about and not get caught up in the minutia of, like, oh, I didn't say a tactical withdrawal. Like, if I'm leaving a building, I'm not tactically one to point, and then the next time I'm not tactically about it. So we just try to have some organization to it, but take your experiences from your organization and try to capture that in one standard document that, you know, we write those manuals for the least common denominator, so that if you don't have a mentor, you don't have someone you could call up and reach out to yet, that you could open this document and go, oh, here's a collection of all the experiences and knowledges of our incident commanders and lessons we learned that's comprised in a flowing document of soup to nuts from on scene until the closure of the incident that really spells it out for you. Then hopefully that gets to the point of, like, one, you have an expectation on the fire ground, and two, you know, that now that person's inclined to try to go find someone to say, I have some questions on this. I don't understand why you guys do this on a high-rise fire, or why you do this on a mid-rise fire. Oh, well, that's where I go find a mentor. And I go reach out to them and say, hey, what's the story behind this? So I think it really is important for those things to kind of marry each other and have it. No manual will ever put a fire out. But as I, you know, kind of share with our group, is like, they're legacy documents. We got to capture the knowledge and experience of what we're doing now so the next generation has that, and then they can continue to refine it.
Chief Heller?
Well, I like the idea of having legacy documents. I think that's great. It's something we don't have. We've used some fairly generic, although our chiefs have altered their command boards. We're pretty much using the same command boards now. We're not strong buggy guys like you guys are in that Virginia, D.C. area. We're still on the front yard quite a bit or on the sidewalk quite a bit. And as the incident escalates, then we end up tied to a command, you know, either a truck or an outside command board, you know, a tabletop that we set up in the street. And it's an ever evolving process for us. I think that they both hold some positives and some negatives. What works for some isn't going to work for others. But the boards themselves, the check sheets themselves, I think can be fairly universal depending on where you're working and what you're doing. And I like that they're that mental reminder. I need that mental reminder. As Ricky said, you know, some of us are pretty gray. We've been doing this a long time, but you still miss points, and it's nice to be able to go down that. I'm in an unfortunate situation where we don't have aides. So it's me, the only chief for 44 square miles, 100,000 people, and that's it. You know, so it stresses you mentally, I think, a little bit more than if I had an aide just, you know, that was driving and I didn't have to worry about the intersections, the siren and the radio and everything that goes at one time. I'd probably do a better job when I got there. But we all have to operate in a different parameter. And I like the idea of having things laid out in front of me because I'm bound to miss something. And that's where having additional chiefs, having a checklist, these are the things that will obviously make the scene a little more a more flowing as far as command goes. And again, my last big point is the chiefs especially, you got to get out in your district and see what's there so you understand how you would command that fire. Years ago, I had a volunteer fire chief tell me, I was an 18-year-old kid, so it's really years ago. He told me, he says, you want to be an officer one day, every time you walk in a building or you're driving down a street, pick out a building, pick out a window or a door, and assume there was fire coming out of that. Start thinking like an officer. What would you do if this was put in front of you? And since that day, I've been doing it, and I do it consistently. And I really do believe that that prepares me in my districts for to be a little more heads up and a little less reactionary, if that makes any sense. But I think this has been an awesome conversation. I really enjoyed it. Tony, I'm sorry we didn't get to hear more from you because I know you've got a ton of good stuff, but we'll get it. And Chief Riley, I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
I appreciate that. I'm sure Tony would definitely. I'll go with that sentiment that Tony had a lot to add. Just we'll get some internet down in Mineral here for the next class. So, but Chief Shaw from Florida, we're getting close to an hour. You got any parting thoughts you want to get in on us here?
Just to kind of tandem off something that Chief Shaw mentioned before when he was talking about hot washes and kind of the mentoring thing. It does start from the top. So if you have that experienced firefighter or chief officer, whoever, that's willing to take that humble approach and explain what went right on scene and what could have been better, that just trickles down. It gives permission for everybody on scene to do the same thing. And then that really good dialogue started. That's a definition of leadership, you know, being able to put yourself out there and lead by example. So I'm glad you brought that up because I'm really passionate on that, you know, trying to set the example and being open and honest and transparent so everybody can learn from things.
Hey, I wanted to kind of leave some, I can't find it anywhere. Does anybody see the video or the Facebook post from, I think it's like Seabrook or something like that, where they had a basement fire and all the plywood I-beams burned away? What was the name of that town? I can't find it. Did anybody remember it?
I do not. It's a recent.
Yeah, it was just like in the last 2 or 3 days.
I saw it yesterday.
Aaron, did you see it?
I saw it yesterday, but I don't recall where it was.
Yeah, I meant to write it down. I've been sitting
Sugar
here.
Sugar Creek Fire and Rescue.
There you go, Tom.
That's it. Tony came through. The internet came through just in time.
Yeah, just in time. Message from the bottle.
So I would ask you all to go research Sugar Creek Fire and Rescue and look at their Facebook post. They had a fire here recently, and I think we've actually done a show talking about 360s on scene reports. I think they wrote a very good, like Dan's talking about, I think within less than a day they had this out where the members could have certainly fallen through the floor rather rapidly into the basement. Mm-hmm. Injuries or death could have certainly resulted from that, but the officer did a really good 360. And identify it as a basement fire, and they attacked it from the basement. So I would ask you to go kind of look at that one. I thought that was a good one just to hit on so everybody goes out and looks at it. So on behalf of Fire Engineering and the Clarion Events Group, we greatly appreciate you tuning in today. Sorry Chief Halton couldn't be on here today with us to talk with us, and Chief Schultz and Dan and Doug Mitchell. We're all busy today, unfortunately, taking care of stuff at their work. But I certainly appreciate Chief Shaw from Florida. We got to see Tony at least. We didn't get to hear him too much, but we did get to see him. And we appreciate that. Chief Heller and Chief Dan Shaw, we greatly appreciate it. And as always, tune in the first Wednesday of next month, and we'll be back on with a new topic. From all of us to Traditionist Training and the International Society of Fire Service Instructors, we appreciate you tuning in. Thanks for everybody for being on. We greatly appreciate it. Have a great day at work.